Happy Yom Ha'atzma'ut. What does that mean?
Yom Ha'atzma'ut.
Day of self-actualization.
Whoa.
Right? So what was self-actualized today? Anyone know?
The State of Israel.
State of Israel. Anyone know when?
1948, right?
1948, very good. So today was the day when the state was declared. And so it's a day of celebration, day of joy, even though normally we're in a period of national mourning, the 33 days after Passover. But the joy over the establishment of the state of Israel overrides it. Now the unfortunate irony is that people had barely finished dancing in the streets, and what happened? The plane started coming overhead, and you had four Arab armies attacking the state of Israel.
And the same year?
The same moment. The same day. So, what we're going to see is that the birth of the state of Israel in itself is totally a miracle. And the fact that it survived its birth is a miracle. And the fact that it's still here today, 66 years later, is totally a miracle. Okay? So how did the state of Israel start? I'm not talking about 1948. Where does it come from? What is the first link of Jews to Israel?
Yes, Zionists.
Well, people often attribute it to Theodor Herzl in the 1880s, 1890s. But let's go before that. What is our link to the land of Israel? Passover, the Jews leaving Egypt, coming to the land, living for 400 years as tribes, another 450 years with the temple, and a second temple. So that's true. But go before the Exodus. Before Passover was Abraham. That's our original link to the land. And God promised to Abraham 3,300 years ago that the covenant, the link between God and the Jewish people, is eternal. And he promised the land to Abraham and his descendants for eternity. Okay? So what's so amazing is that we were gone for 2,000 years, unprecedented, having a country there. But what's important to know about Zionism is for the last 2,000 years, since the Second Temple was destroyed, since the Romans destroyed the Jewish presence in Israel, Jews have always been in Israel. The history of Zionism doesn't go back to the 1890s. It goes back to Abraham, but more immediately it goes back 2,000 years. Because the only period where Jews were not in Israel was for about 60 years after the first Crusaders entered Israel. The Christians kicked us out completely, and then when the Muslims reconquered it, we came back. But other than that, there have always been Jews in Israel. Okay, that's important to know. And second of all, in terms of, you know, I don't want to get too much into the politics, but whose land is it? Starting in the 1860s, at least in Jerusalem, there was a Jewish majority. In the land in general, there were about twice as many Arabs as Jews, but by the time of the State of Israel was declared, 66 years ago today or yesterday, but there was a majority of Jews in Jerusalem starting in the 1860s. That's important to know. Okay. Now, how did we get a state? It doesn't just happen, right? So let's start talking about the modern political Zionist movement. And then we'll talk about how Israel came about. So we talked last week about the history of anti-Semitism. We talked about the Dreyfus trial. French officer who was accused of spying for the Germans, very clearly framed because of anti-Semitic motives. And in fact, 15 years later, he was exonerated. But very clearly framed, and at that trial was a young journalist named, who's the father of modern political Zionism, Theodor Herzl. And he was a very assimilated Jew, like Dreyfus was. And we know, I mean, yeah, probably all know people, Jewish people, who don't celebrate Yom Kippur or don't celebrate, nothing. Yet, at that event, when he saw the anti-Semitism, the depth of the anti-Semitism, he had a type of epiphany. A type of means awakening, enlightenment, right? A moment. Epiphany tends to be one moment that changes everything. And that was, he realized that anti-Semitism was nothing was going to get rid of it, despite the fact that the Jews had tried for 50 years to act as European as they could. And the only solution was to get the Jews out of Europe. And he started a Zionist movement. He had two plans. One, to get all the Jews together and united behind this. And two, now, what was going on in Israel at the time? Anyone know? The Turks. It was part of the Ottoman Empire, which had been for about 400 years. So he had to go to the Sultan of Turkey. Now, Herzl was a rather clever fellow, and he wrote some very inspiring books about the return to Zion, reestablishing a Jewish country. But he was also an astute politician. So what he did is he went to the Jewish bankers to ask them to bankroll this endeavor. And you had the Rothschilds, and you had, you know, Hamburgers, and very serious, significant wealth. And he basically got a flat no. You're dreaming, you know, this isn't realistic. The Rothschilds had started to fund agricultural colonies, little, small ones, but he was asking for, you know, enormous sums to bankroll this endeavor and to go to the Sultan of Turkey. How does everything work in the Middle East? Bakshish, bribes, right? You gotta grease the palm. So he needed a war chest, didn't get it. But when he went to the Sultan of Turkey, he called a good bluff. Well, you know, I just met with so-and-so and so-and-so and so-and-so. He wasn't impressed. Sent him packing. Didn't stop him. He convened, called for the Zionist Congress, which was representatives from all over Europe to meet to start this project, to get it off the ground. And the first one was in Basel, I believe, in Switzerland. And at the first Zionist Congress, there were 117 Jewish groups that gathered. 3 years later, in 1901 or 1900, there were 913. So you see how it took off. In 3 years, they got close to 1,000 Jewish organizations, representatives from all over Europe. And what he said, what Herzl said after the first one, he said, if I said this aloud, people would laugh at me. But he said, maybe not in 5 years, we might not have a state. But he said, in 50 years, mark my words, we will have a Jewish state. And what's so amazing is that to the date, 50 years after 1898 was 1948, 50 years later, his words came true. There was a Jewish state. Okay. Now, even before Herzl, there was already a type of Zionist movement. They were religious thinkers. It was the age of nationalism, of people reclaiming their national identity and heritage. And the first Aliyah, and there were different ways of Aliyah, already had occurred. There were already Jewish groups who were establishing agricultural settlements, as I said before. At that time, there were 50,000 Jews and 200,000 Arabs. So a quarter of the population, or a fifth of the population, was Jewish. By 1939, you had 900,000 Arabs, significantly more, and 450,000 Jews. So Jews became close to a third of the population from a quarter, okay? So what drove this? So at first it was ideological, we said. It was Jewish nationalism. And many of them were not religious. Some of them were religious. Some of them, it wasn't a religious impetus. It was a realizing either Jews didn't fit into Europe, Jews weren't welcome in Europe, it was dangerous in Europe, and we needed our own country. We needed to remember, it was also the age of isms, right? Socialism, communism, and at the head of the people who were idealistic were the Jews. So the first Aliyah were the lovers of Zion, and 7,000 idealistic dreamers went, and it was very hard. You go to Degania, next to the Sea of Galilee, you see the cemetery, and many of them died from malaria, draining swamps. The life was very brutal. In the winter, at night, it gets very cold. They were living in tents. They had to clear rocks out of the ground. And these were what we would call kind of middle-class kids. You know, these weren't people who were used to working the land. These were idealistic kids. And that's how it began. But by the 1904 was the second Aliyah, 1915 to 1920. A lot of it was people fleeing Europe because of anti-Semitism. In Russia, there were pogroms. Many came to America, right? We know the big influx. My grandfather came on a boat in 1898. They fled Odessa, where things must have not been great for the Jews. History repeats itself, right? As we know. What's going on in Odessa today, big upheavals. So people are fleeing anti-Semitism. And that's how the numbers started to grow. Some of them idealistic, some of them simply to get out of the terrors of Europe. And not everyone could make it to America. Some went to Palestine. Okay. Now at the same time, and this is what's so interesting, is we're going to see, as I told you before, really, the whole existence of Israel is a miracle. The whole survival of Israel is a miracle. So we're going to talk about several of these miracles, okay? The first incredible set of circumstances was that there, in England, there happened to be a Jewish chemist who played a critical role in World War One. He invented the firing caps that allowed them to detonate dynamite to create explosives. And that scientist, chemist, was Azar Weitzman, who was Jewish. And he was also a passionate Zionist. And he lobbied the British government, and particularly Lord Balfour. Now the British, interestingly enough, were also, for religious reasons, very Zionist. There's a whole history of Christians supporting Jews returned to Israel. Today, the millions of dollars, tens of millions of dollars, are channeled from evangelical groups to Israel. And some people are very wary of taking their money. Basically, they want Jews to be in Israel. Why? That's Christian theology, is that when you know who comes back, they believe that the Jews should be there to greet him and then to join the cause. That's why they want us there. So some people say, you know, that's why they want us there. We shouldn't take their money. Other people say, you know, when Messiah comes, we'll see if he's Jewish or the other guy, right? And then we'll know. So there were Christians who were very supportive. In fact, George Bush's great grandfather was very involved in establishing agricultural settlements in the Holy Land, interestingly enough. So Weizmann petitioned the British government because the British government had just gotten their hands on a nice piece of real estate. It was called Transjordan and Palestine. When the Turks lost the First World War, the Western countries chopped up their empire. Syria went to France, and Palestine and Transjordan became a British mandate. Mandate to do what? Mandate to figure out what to do with it, with no specific answer. And a year later, in 1919, the British government issued the Balfour Declaration, saying that the mandate they felt should happen is that you should create a Jewish homeland in the Holy Land. That was their view of what should be done. Now, 3 years later, there was an international conference of the beginning of the League of Nations. No one wanted world wars anymore, and they believed form a League of Nations and you will create a world understanding that will prevent a world war. Unfortunately, we know that despite its idealistic motives, it didn't turn out so well. The Second World War was worse than the First. But one of the results of the San Remo Conference was that they ratified the Balfour Declaration and they declared that Palestine should be a Jewish homeland. Now, at the same time, oil was becoming much more important. Model T, the Ford, the cars, the incredible explosion of automobiles. And the British realized that who has control over the oil? You know the famous joke when Moses came out of Egypt. If he'd only turned right instead of turning left, he would have wound up in Saudi Arabia, not in Israel. Now, today we know that there actually is oil in Israel. They just found enormous gas reserves, which are going to last Israel for 30 years of their energy needs and allow them to export. So it was a little delay, but we finally found it there too. But oil started to become important, and the British started to backtrack, started to backpedal. And first thing they did is they chopped off 4/5 of Transjordan and gave it to the Hashemites, who were a tribe from Saudi Arabia, from the desert. And they established the kingdom of Jordan, which is today's modern-day Jordan. Then the rest of what was left, Palestine, they started by the 1930s to close the doors to Jews and to limit immigration. Now, there was tension. The Arabs rioted in 1929, 1930s. Things started to get tense, and the British realized that if we want to keep the Arabs happy, we've got to start closing the doors to Jews. And tragically, right before World War II, in 1939, they issued a white paper saying, no more Jews allowed in Palestine, or maybe a few thousand a year. And of course, the tragedy, terrible tragedy, is that the British were accessories to the slaughter of hundreds of thousands of Jews who had nowhere to flee. And if they'd only opened up the doors, as they mandate said, this was supposed to be a homeland for the Jewish people, you could have had a place for refugees to flee from the Holocaust. Could have saved hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of lives. But it didn't suit their politics, and it went on deaf ears.
So just a question, so why did they do that? I mean, did they realize that...
It's called politics. Why does America sit by while 120,000 people are slaughtered in Syria, but a few buildings are broken in Russia and everyone's up in arms? It's called politics. And despite our airs of, you know, idealism and human rights and protection of human rights, bottom line, we don't want to stick our necks out unless we've got some skin in the game, as they say. Unless there's something in it for us, right? 1990s, America bombs Bosnia-Herzegovina. They get involved in the war in Europe, while in Rwanda, 900,000 people are slaughtered with machetes. 600,000? Okay, sorry. I'm only 300,000 off. So, what is that? It's called politics. Yeah. Last week we talked about them not bombing the railroad tracks to Auschwitz. And 600,000 people gassed in the last 6 months of the war. Could have been averted.
Depends on where our values and where we'll get benefits.
Exactly.
Which is too bad.
Yeah. So it's called politics. And so what was the Jewish reaction? So they tried to run the blockade, to smuggle Jews into Palestine, to get them out of Europe and just get them into Palestine. Somewhat successful. And the famous statement was, we're going to fight the white paper, the British closing off Palestine, as if there was no war, but we're going to fight the war and help the British as if there was no white paper. So Jews in Palestine were in a very contradictory position. Same time the British were preventing them from getting in, same time the British were the ones fighting against the Nazis. So, and this is the attitude they took. So they would smuggle Jews in and at the same time go volunteer for the British Brigade. And by the way, there were tens of thousands of Jews who volunteered to fight the Nazis. You know how many Arabs volunteered? In fact, the Mufti of Jerusalem packed off to Berlin. And there's one theory that he incited Hitler to be even worse towards the final solution. And the British still kept the doors closed. It's unbelievable if you think about it. Unbelievable. So, last week we talked about the Holocaust, the murder of 6 million Jews. And the war is over in 1945. And there's still not some 600,000, a million displaced persons wandering around Europe with no place to go. And what's the natural... And they couldn't... Some of them didn't want to go back to their homes. Some of them couldn't go back to their homes. In fact, at Fifth Avenue Synagogue, Yaffa Eliyahu founded the first Jewish Studies Holocaust program in the United States in Brooklyn College in the 1960s. Her family went back home to Poland in 1946, and while she was hidden in a closet, her mother was slaughtered right in front of her. 1946.
By Poland? Polish.
By Polish. Yeah. So, couldn't go home. So where do you go? There's nowhere to go. And here comes another, against all odds, incredible story. And that's the story of the Jewish freedom fight. Because now that the war was over, some of these displaced persons, they stepped up the efforts to run these boats into Palestine, to run the British blockade. And what is the most famous one of them called? Anyone know? Anyone see the movie or the book? Read the book by Leon Uris?
Yes.
Exodus.
Right. Famous book. They would pile hundreds of Jews onto these old boats that they bought and load them on in Italy or France, trying to avoid the British spies who were trying to find out where they were going. And they try to run the blockade, some successfully, some unsuccessfully. When they couldn't, they were taken, put in camps by the British, many of them deported to Cyprus, put back behind barbed wire. These are people who had gone through the horrors of the Holocaust, and that's what the British were doing. And so they decided, amongst them, particularly Menachem Begin, who would later become Prime Minister, and the Irgun, the Independent Fighting Force, to take on the mighty British Empire. And they started a guerrilla war. Now, you'll ask, what? You know, and then the Palestinians say, oh, you call us terrorists, how about your Menachem Begin? He's a terrorist. He did the same thing, stealing weapons, attacking. So what is the difference? The difference between a terrorist and a freedom fighter is a freedom fighter fights a war. In other words, they fight military against military. Terrorists attack civilians, women, children, non-military. And so by and large the policy was to not attack civilians, but to attack British military emplacements because they were not fulfilling their mandate, which was to create a homeland for the Jewish people. In fact, not only were doing that, they were turning Jews back away who had gone through the Holocaust. And so for the next 3 years, from 1945 to 1947, it was all out war. And you can read Malcolm's book, Revolt. There are many books about this. You can read The Hope by Herman Wouk. Some of the stories are unbelievable. You know, the chutzpah they had. Some of them who'd served in the British Army still had their uniforms, had their British accents. They would dress up like a British officer, march into a British camp, load up a truck with weapons, say, we're requisitioned, give them some requisition papers, and march out. They would ambush trains that they knew were full of arms. And this is how they started to wear down the British. Till 1948, fall of 1948, the British finally, and by the way, at the same time, they had to be defending themselves against the Arabs. Because the British, who were supposed to be impartial, when Arabs attacked Jews, by and large, would stand by and do nothing. But when they found a Jew who with weapons, they confiscated their weapons. At one point, the British got so frustrated, they started trying and executing Jewish freedom fighters. What did they do? They kidnapped British officers and strung them up. And when the British saw that the Jews weren't going to be pushed over so easily, they stopped executing Jewish freedom fighters. And there was a standoff, so to speak. Still putting many in prison. A lot of them they would take to Eritrea, which is modern-day Somalia, which was a British colony. They'd ship them off to Africa, ship them to Canada, Australia, whatever they could do. And finally, by 1947, the British were sick of it. They threw up their hands. They said to the UN, these Jews are impossible. You figure out what to do with all this. They gave up. And what did they do? So the UN had already commissioned a report called the Peel Commission. And what they suggested is, because the Jews and the Arabs were constantly fighting as well, so they suggested that they establish a commission. I'll show it to you in a second. They suggested they establish two countries and bring this to a vote in the UN. So in November 1947, this was brought before the UN, the proposal of it's called the Partition Plan. Now, once again, one of the miracles, as we know, the world didn't particularly like Jews. They just killed 6 million of us. Almost all of Europe had collaborated in the extermination of 6 million Jews, and the rest of the world just stood by and watched, including the United States of America. And what likelihood was there of winning a vote in the UN? So here's again against all odds. So the first factor that fell into line was Stalin. And Joseph Stalin wound up voting for the establishment of the two states, Jewish and Palestinian. Why? Because the early Zionists were also, many of them, socialists. Right? The kibbutz, communes, many of them were Bundists. Leftists, and he hoped that he could have an ally in the Middle East. That if he voted for the establishment of Israel, the Jewish state might be sympathetic to Russia and communism. Remember, he had just run across half of Europe, now had all these Eastern European satellite states, and was building an empire, right? The Union of Soviet Socialist Republics. So it would be great to have another one in the Middle East. So once Stalin voted for Israel, the rest of the Eastern Bloc voted as well. But the linchpin was really the United States. What would Harry Truman do? And Harry Truman, it's ironic because it appears that certainly Lady Bird Johnson, and even Franklin to some extent, was sympathetic to the Jews but did nothing. Truman appeared to be a little bit of an anti-Semite. He was upset at the Jews, he was being frustrated, except there was an Achilles heel. The Achilles heel was that his former very close friend and the first business partner in their haberdashery store, the age when they had haberdashery stores, I guess that's what you bought here, you know, your gray felt hat, in Kansas City, of all places, his original partner was a Jew named Jacobson. What's his name? Yeah, his first name. And the Zionist movement enlisted him to go pay a visit to his old buddy Harry. And if anyone could get a meeting with Truman, it was him. Remember, in 1944, when the rabbis, 400 rabbis, marched on Washington because Jews were being exterminated in Europe, they marched on Washington, asked and then demanded a meeting with Roosevelt, doors were closed. So if he wouldn't even meet with American rabbis pleading for Jews who were being exterminated, why should Harry Truman meet with Zionists about forming a new country for Jews? So Jacobson goes in and he says, "What do you expletive deleted want?" And he said, "You're going to, you know, hawk me about the Jews again? It just caused me headaches." And he looked at, on his desk, apparently there was a statue of Andrew Jackson, Truman's hero. He said, "You have your hero, right? Jackson." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "I have my hero. And all I'm asking you is to meet my hero." And that hero was Weizmann. And so Weizmann got a meeting with Truman. Somehow, Truman's will got changed, and Truman saw himself, and this is amazing, he wrote in his memoirs, in when the Jews returned from Babylon, King Cyrus gave them the permission to reestablish a Jewish country in Israel. And he says, "I am the modern-day Cyrus." He saw himself as this, in doing this, this leader, world leader of, you know, bringing about this turn of circumstances for this historic people of the Bible. So he saw himself in that role. America votes for the establishment of the state. The rest of the Western Bloc votes. Europe will guilt over having killed 6 million Jews as well. And the state of Israel is, the vote for the UN partition plan is declared. Now, look at this map. We're going to look at map number 2. So we have three events, three miraculous events. The first one, the Balfour Declaration, that Britain would say, "We want to establish, we have now taken Palestine to establish a Jewish state." The second miracle was that the Jewish ragtag fighters had been able to kick out the British Empire, right? Unbelievable. And I'm not sure if India got its independence before, but remember, India had, maybe it wasn't a billion people back then, it was a half a billion people. Gandhi just put them in the streets and the whole country shuts down. What did we have here? We had, you know, a few hundred thousand Jews against the mighty British Empire. The third miracle was the vote in the UN. Here's the fourth miracle. Look at map number 2. This was the partition plan. And if you look at it, it's, talk about cockamamie, right? The white areas are the Jewish areas. What do you notice about this? And the dark areas are the Arab areas. What do you notice about the Jewish areas? How many countries are there here? What'd you say?
Most of the areas that the Jews are either extreme mountains or desert or very arid.
Well, they did give them the coastal plain, okay? And part of the Galilee. They gave us the Negev Desert, very arid, correct? But what do you notice that's strange about this map?
It's divided.
It's more than divided. What is it? It's a jigsaw puzzle. So each population had a jigsaw puzzle. You see that? That only touched at those cross points. Talk about flash points, right? So that one little point is where you would have the crossover from Jewish area to Jewish area and Arab area to Arab area. Crazy. Nuts. But this is the plan such as it was. Now, between 47, fall of 47 and spring of 48, the problem was that the Jews were not allowed to have weapons. They knew if they declared a state, what would happen? The Arabs would attack. So even though the UN voted for a partition plan, there was enormous debate amongst the Jewish leaders, should we declare a state and be attacked? We have nothing. We have no weapons. Now, a few months before, in 1947, they'd sent a young woman to America. And she arrived in the United States, and somehow someone sponsored her to get a visa, to a tourist visa. She arrived penniless, nothing with her. They said to her, "Where are you going?" She's going, "I'm going home." where is your home? So she happened to have been born in Russia, grew up in Minnesota, but she said, my home is with my family. Where? Who's your family? She said, the Jewish people. And Golda Meir arrived. Her goal was to raise $5 million so that they could buy weapons to defend the new country. After her tour of 4 or 5 months, she wound up raising $50 million, which for that time, remember, this is at the end of World War II. This is $50 million back then is like, I don't know, hundreds of millions, if not billion dollars now. So another against all odds. And she would go on, as we know, to become prime minister. I don't know, was she the first female prime minister of any country? Interesting thing to look up, I'm not sure. Gandhi's daughter, was she? No, she was after it. In any case, so there's an enormous debate, do we declare a country and get attacked? And most of the Jewish leaders were against it. Except for whom? David Ben-Gurion. And he somehow knew that this was a historic opportunity, it wouldn't be paralleled. Of course, he took the gamble of having 500,000 Jews. I mean, they knew if the Arabs won, they would be slaughtered on the spot, thrown into the sea. It was going for broke. It was all or nothing. And they declared a Jewish state. People were dancing in the streets, and the next day, picking up their rifles to go defend the new country with virtually no weapons, because the British had prevented the Jews from bringing weapons in, arrested Jews who had any weapons, while the Arabs had no such, were passing back and forth across the border. When the British pulled out, all of the strategic fortresses, they built a whole series of fortresses around the country, which are still there today. Famous one in Latrun. You go on the road from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv on the right, going downhill. There's a tank museum. That was the British fortress. Where else? In Jerusalem, on the, it's called the Hill of Evil Counsel, but it's actually where the UN met. It was one of those fortresses. All of the high spots, they gave them all to the Arabs. Remember, this is the British who was supposed to be impartial. And so what they had to do is, immediately upon declaring a state, to pick up their rifles and start funneling in all the weapons that Golda Meir had raised the money for. And there, I've met people, they said, oh yeah, my father said that he went down to the docks in the middle of the night, loading rifles into, you know, cases of tractor parts. So they did try to smuggle in. Eventually the borders opened when we declared a state. Virtually the only country that sold, that would sell us weapons was, I don't know, Czechoslovakia. The Czech Republic has often is the least anti-Semitic country in Europe, and was favorably disposed towards Israel. They had lots of war surplus, World War II surplus, still lying around, and that's how they started to get their first weapons. There were some homemade weapons. You can visit the bullet factory, and I think it's Petah Tikva. They built an underground bunker where they manufactured bullets, in hiding from the British. So now the borders were open, and tens, if not hundreds of thousands, of refugees from the Shoah came into Israel as well. And some of them, they would give them a rifle. They'd arrive in Israel, get a couple of meals, sleep a couple of nights, get a day of training, give them a rifle, and send out into the battles. Tragically, many of them fell in battle, heroically, trying to defend the new state of Israel. And slowly the tide turned. They started winning some of the battles. And the Arabs would declare a ceasefire. The Arabs would rearm. The Jews would also rearm. They'd start fighting again, and we'd take more. So we took back Lod. And we took back Yaffa. And what happened was, and this is very controversial, as the Jewish forces started to advance, the Arabs would flee. They'd run away. For instance, in Sfat, who here has been to Sfat, town of mystics, northern Israel. In Sfat, there were some, like 2,000 Jews and 10,000 Arabs, Palestinians. How do you win? So, once again, miracles. So, first of all, the Arab armies themselves, and we have the recordings, would broadcast to the Palestinian population, telling them, pull out, come behind the lines, so we can go in, slaughter everyone, and then you'll come back and they get not just your houses, but the Jewish houses. And that's what they did. They were also terrified of the Jews. There were some battles, like Deir Yassin, where the road next to the town next to the road between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, the Arabs kept launching terrorist attacks against Jewish trucks, civilians, ambulances, and so they decided to take the town. They broadcast with loudspeakers, clear out, leave the town, any civilians, we don't want to hurt you. Some of them did clear out, but others didn't. And what happened was they won the battle. There were some 30 Arab soldiers that were killed, fighters. And they took over the town. They brought the civilians into an area. And some of the civilians dressed as women were men with guns under their robes. They lifted up their guns, shot at the Jewish soldiers. Jewish soldiers shot back. There were some civilians killed. The Arabs said there was the Jews massacred the civilian population and started broadcasting that all over. In one case, they said they burned 26 Arabs alive in one battle. The UN sent an investigator, found nothing of the sort. But these Arab tales of Jewish atrocities also caused more Arabs to flee. There were some cases like Deir Yassin where they also had to remove the Arab populations because they were launching attacks from the civilian populations. The laws of war are soldiers had to be dressed in uniform, out of civilian areas, and fighting. The Arabs had them dressed as civilians, fighting from within civilian areas. So who's to blame? You know, Benny Morris is a historian, tried to figure out how many villages fled on their own, how many were removed by the Israelis, how many... Very hard to know. I do have the figures here somewhere, but most of them, actually, he says, he's not sure. It's hard to tell. So... I do have the figures here somewhere. Here we go. This is what he found. 228 villages were evacuated due to attacks from Jewish forces. So 41 were expelled by military forces. So 200 were caught in the crossfire and they ran away. 40 villages we kicked out because they were fighting from within the villages. 90... they were panicked because other villages were attacked and they just ran away. And 6 left because they were told to do so by the Palestinian authorities. And 46 towns, he doesn't know why they were empty. And this, of course, is a big contention. In the end, there were some 600,000 Palestinian refugees who fled across the border to Lebanon, to Jordan, to Gaza, to Syria, to all the neighboring countries. In Sfat, there was an incredible story of the Davidka. If you walk along Jerusalem Street at the top, not the old city where the synagogue's at the top, there's the Davidka. What's the Davidka? They took a pipe, a smaller pipe, took a third pipe, stuffed the pipe with gunpowder, put a top on it, stuck it in the pipe, lit it, it went... but it created an unbelievable sound. Now that afternoon, it happened to have rained. And apparently, after Hiroshima, after you have nuclear fallout, it causes rain. And there was a place between, the British had, if you go to Sfat today, there's a stairway going right up through the middle of the old city, dividing the Jewish quarter and the artist quarter. The artist quarter used to be the Arabs, where the Arab houses. And the British created this corridor to separate the two, but the women would stand on either side cursing at each other, the Jewish and Arab women, then when the fighting was going on. So the Arab woman, when the rain came after this loud explosion, there was a rumor started that the Jews had nuclear weapons. Now, how did 2,000 Jews overcome 10,000 Arabs? Like, the Jewish woman apparently didn't contradict this rumor, and the Arabs fled and left. And so you had these crazy, I mean, talk about miracles against all odds. Preposterous. So all of these factors combined, from the Arabs broadcasting to pull back behind their lines, to the exaggerations of Jewish atrocities, to some people just seem simply being caught in the crossfire, or, you know, these kind of rumors of nuclear fallout led to Arabs emptying out of many of these areas, so that when you had, look at number five, the final armistice, which was called in 1949, the Jewish state wound up being the whole white area. And as you see, significantly growing, and most importantly, becoming contiguous. No longer do you have this this puzzle of sorts, that jigsaw puzzle created. And so you had the final map of the pre-1967 state of Israel. And so that was the fifth miracle, was the fleeing of Arab populations. Now, at the same time, sorry, not at the same time. Any questions up until now? All good? So, State of Israel declared, and you had a massive movement. There was an attempt to broker a peace, which did not go anywhere. The Arabs did not want to talk peace. And instead, what they did is they turned around and started expelling the Jewish populations from Arab countries. So interestingly enough, if you flip over your map, what do you see here? Between 1948 and 1967, these are all of the Jews who were kicked out of Muslim countries.
It's amazing how Morocco and Iraq, which are two of the smallest countries besides Yemen and Aden, had the largest populations sent away.
Yeah. Yeah. By the way, the King of Morocco is inviting back Moroccan Jews to come back to his country. So in the end, you had 600,000 Jews expelled from Arab countries and their lands taken away, all their belongings confiscated. So you see where this is going. You know, when you talk about refugees and the right of return, a big issue in the negotiations with the Palestinians is the right of return. What does that mean? They want the 600,000 Palestinians to be able to go back to their homes. And then the question is, well, does 600,000 Jews have a right to their property returned? The other interesting point is, how do you rule on this in international law? You think, how would you ever rule on it? So there actually is a precedent. Very interesting precedent. In the Revolutionary War in America, there were Tories. I don't know who the Tories were. The Tories were Americans who were pro-British. And by and large, during the Revolutionary War, the Tories, when the revolutionaries advanced, the Tories would run away because they were afraid of reprisals. So they ran away. So there were Tories in Long Island, Connecticut. They fled to Canada. The war ends. The revolutionaries win. The United States of America is established. And what do they say? These refugees come to America and say, we want to go back to our houses. And what do they tell them? Sorry, guys, no deal. You chose sides, and you happen to have chosen the wrong one. And so, apparently, according to international law, if people are displaced before the creation of a country, and then the country is created, there's no obligation to repatriate them. Okay. The other interesting point is that what happened to the 600,000 Jewish refugees? Where are the refugee camps?
Israel absorbed them all.
They absorbed them. They're Israelis. What happened to 600,000 Palestinians? They stuck them in camps. The Lebanese, the Syrians, the Jordanians, the Egyptians, and to this very day they are sitting in camps. Now, what is the definition of a refugee?
person displaced by war or other strife in a country.
Right.
But usually only
the person who was, right? The person who was displaced. Their children are no longer technically refugees, except the UN created a special, there's the refugee board, and then the UN has UNRPRW, United, whatever, the Palestinian War Refugee Board, which has different rules. And they declare any descendants of refugees are refugees. You've got fifth generation today who they declare as refugees, who are not refugees. They were born and grew up in Lebanon, Syria, Jordan, Gaza, and their brothers will not let them out of the camps. So, in essence, they are being used as political pawns to barter against Israel. And it's a terrible tragedy. But in a lot of ways, it's not Israel's, for Israel to rectify it. Because we are now four or five generations later. So these are some of the issues that directly came out of the War of Independence and that are still alive today. And you know, so I bring them up and highlight them to show so people know the background, because you really have to know the history of it to understand the debates today and to understand the arguments that are going back and forth and the low right of return and who these Palestinians are, in order to really understand why they fled in the first place, which is a whole mixture of different. The Israelis dropped, this is well known, dropped leaflets over the Palestinian populations, telling them, do not leave. You can stay, and if you can stay, and you'll be accepted as part of this new country. Now, originally, the UN partition plan was supposed to have 100,000 Jews living in Palestinian areas and 100,000 Palestinians living in Jewish areas. Okay? And of course, we accepted it, and we accepted the partition plan. Palestinians never accepted the partition plan. And after the state, sure enough, the Arabs who stayed were given citizenship in Israel. And to today, there are a fifth of the population of Israel is Arab. And they're Israeli citizens, and they vote, and they're part of the country. You might have heard that the new Palestinian state they want to form will not be allowed to have any Jews. Why no one calls them on that or asks them why, you know, except I posted on Facebook last week this dry bones, I don't see that, it's an Israeli cartoon, and he says, this is John Kerry speak, okay, Israel absorbs Arab citizens into their country, and it's called an apartheid state. The Palestinians want to kick all the Jews out of their country, and it's called moderate and peace-seeking. And double standard is incredible, unfortunately. So you have the situation now. In order to briefly talk about the next 60 years of Israeli history in 10 minutes, okay, I'll give you the broad overview. As we know, the next war will be fought over, well, as a result of the next war in 1967, I'm not going to get into the details of the 1967 war, but in 1956 and 1967, the Arab armies amassed at the border, ready to attack Israel. 67, Israel preemptively struck the Arab countries, wiped out their air forces, they attacked. And the area in this circle here, known as the West Bank, right? So after the Syrians and Egyptians attacked, apparently they sent word to Jordan. They told them, don't attack. We have nothing against you. Jordan controlled the West Bank. What did Jordanians do? They attacked. And eventually Israel pushed the Jordanians out of the West Bank and retook this whole area. Now, what do they call the West Bank today? They call it the occupied territories. Who was it occupied from? Who had it before Israel? The Jordanians. How did the Jordanians get it? No, they didn't. The English pulled out. The UN voted a partition plan. Under the partition plan, this was supposed to go to the Palestinians. The Palestinians and the Jordanians reject the partition plan. The Jordanians invade, take over this territory, and never annex it as part of Jordan. So the fact is, no one ever took jurisdiction over this piece of real estate. Certainly not the British after they pulled out. Not the Palestinians after the partition plan the UN wanted to give to them. Not the Jordanians. And not the Israelis either. It's no man's land. And the large majority of it was state-owned land. Originally by the Turks, then by the British, then by the Jordanians, then by Israel. But Israel, it's not occupied because no one owned it. And that's how the rhetoric, you know, these expressions are thrown around, occupied territories, no one occupied it. Illegal. It's nothing illegal. No one ever took ownership over it. So that's something to be aware of in terms of, and now hopefully you understand the whole history of it. You've got to go back all the way, right, to 1948, and then 1947, and 1922, the San Remo. The League of Nations declared this area to be a Jewish homeland. That's the last internationally declared status of this piece of real estate. Because in 1947, the Palestinians rejected the partition plan. They never embraced it. They never wanted it. Because they wanted everything. And in the process, they got nothing. And once again, it's too bad. We feel bad for them. But that was the reality of the situation. So the state of Israel really was formed on a series of miracles, one after the other. As we said, from the Balfour Declaration, this Jewish scientist petitioned the British government to declare a Jewish homeland, to the Jewish freedom fighters who kicked out the British, to Golda Meir who raises the money for the army, to the Palestinians fleeing that area. And then if you cycle ahead to 1967, once again, I don't have time to get into the details of the 1967 war, but the Six-Day War was truly a miracle. The quickness with which the Israeli army was able to wipe out enemy air forces, and then in 6 days to not just stop the war, the invasion, but to push them back. And so during that period, Israel eventually took the West Bank, the Golan Heights, and the Gaza Strip. And they kind of basked in the incredible victory. They were very heady days where Israel felt they were almost invincible. The Arabs wouldn't dare do anything after being trounced in 1956 and 1967. And 6 years later, on Yom Kippur, they attacked again. And this time, instead of a few hundred losses, there were over 1,700 Israeli soldiers killed, 6,000 injured. And the Yom Kippur War in 1973 was a very fierce war, which Israel barely scraped through and was able to win. And that settled into... By the way, after 1967, Israel came to the Arab countries and said, we want to give this back to you. We want to give back the Sinai, give back the West Bank, give back the Golan Heights. What do we want in exchange?
Peace.
And there was the three famous no's of the Khartoum Conference. They had a community conference in Sudan. No negotiation, no peace, and no recognition of Israel. And what's so interesting is that from, you know, before 1967, there was never any call for a Palestinian state. Jordan was sitting in the West Bank. No one was ever calling for a Palestinian state. Israel takes it over and a Palestinian nationalist movement. And eventually, after 35, 40 years of labor governments in Israel, Menachem Begin, the right-wing hawk, is elected in and sits down at the negotiation table with Anwar Sadat, and they declare peace between Egypt and Israel. Israel gives back the Sinai. And 12 years later, 1992, Yitzhak Rabin sits down with Yasser Arafat to make peace. The Oslo Accords, they try to at least have the beginnings of peace negotiations, which quickly broke down, and launched the first intifada, the second intifada, and to this day, as we know, this issue of what to do with the West Bank is still hotly debated. They just ended on another round of peace talks, which led nowhere, despite John Kerry trying so hard to lead it somewhere. And we're really in kind of a status quo position of what will be, we don't know. And unfortunately, Israel, many people view the whole issue of the West Bank secondary to the what we call the existential threat of Iranian nuclear weapons building. And so here we are at 66th anniversary of Israel. There's still a lot of question marks. But what's most important to realize is that the whole movement started on miracles against all odds. The state of Israel was established on miracles against all odds. It survived the 1967-1973 wars on miracles against all odds. And what will be? Look, we know that the only reason Israel's here is a bunch of miracles that can't really be explained. And so we try our best. We pray. We hope. A little Jewish ingenuity. And what will be? We just hope that we're worthy, that God continues to give us this blessing of the land of Israel. We have to realize that for 2,000 years, Jews prayed and yearned and dreamed of returning to Zion. And a few scragglers were able to make it back. And here, all we have to do is go out and buy a ticket to a plane and get on an LL plane and fly over there. My one distant relative, who's not really a blood, he's by marriage, my great uncle, married his aunt by marriage. But he came and he showed me the mud house that his grandfather built after he walked from Russia to Palestine. That's how he got there. Okay? We get on a plane. We don't realize the miracle, the privilege, and the ease with which we have it. And make no mistakes. Look what's happening in Ukraine today. My dentist is Anton Feldman, lives right here in the building as we do. And Feldman's a big name from Odessa. I mentioned my father's family was from Odessa originally. And he said that his aunt runs the Jewish school they're packing up. And thank God, fortunately, they have a place to go. They can go to Israel. And 70 years ago, the Jews had no place to go. Things get bad in different parts of the world. Jews will always have a place to go. And that wasn't also. It's something that we should see as a blessing and appreciate. And things are good now in America. They should always stay good. But unfortunately, Jewish history is that they haven't always stayed good. When things turn bad, things turn hard, first people to be blamed are the Jews. And we just have to be proud and thankful of our homeland and try to visit it this summer. You can join us on our MJ trip to Israel. And on this Yom HaTzmaut, this Israel Independence Day, we should remember the blessing, be grateful for it, learn about it, know how we got it, so we know how to answer and how to be proud and say, the San Remo Conference, the world declared this as a Jewish homeland. We bought the land. We accepted a partition plan. The Arabs rejected it. And believe me, when they're ready to really put down their weapons, there will be peace. Until that time, unfortunately, there won't. Any questions?
Actually, I have a comment.
Yeah.
I wanted to recommend everyone to watch this movie called
prime ministers. Like probably a lot of people saw it. So it talks about.
I read the book. Unbelievable.
So I watched. I saw the first part. The two parts of it. So it's.
Totally the exactly saga about of the story. Of the
about Golda Meir and Menachem Begin and the other prime ministers.
Well, that's not the founding. That's modern Israel. The founding.
I think it was.
It started also.
Yeah, it's part of okay. That's part one, and part two is later.
Yeah, another great recommendation. Yeah. Lee, you want to tell us what's coming up at MJE?
Sure. Yeah. I just want to say thanks to everybody for coming out. Great class tonight. Also, if you didn't sign in with me, come find me. And also, the class is $5. Next week, we'll have Lechaim, How to Party the Jewish Way. And also, it's our event, as you can see, the Feather of Bruce with the Jews. So if anybody comes to the class, you'll go a little bit late to the event, but you'll get a discount from the class and the beer tasting. It should be a really fun event. It's a guided tasting, 14 different craft beers on tap. So
what we're going to do is we're going to have class here. Everyone's welcome to come. And we're going to talk about Lechaim. And then we're going to walk 6 blocks to 86th Street and go to the beer tasting where there'll be a larger crowd of other people from MJE. And you'll get a special discount, an extra discount, for having come to the class. So
what's next Tuesday?
Next week.
So the beer tasting is what, $20?
To register in advance, it's $20. And to if you get there the day of, it's $25. And if you have any questions, email me, lea@jewishexperience.com.
And we'll give you an extra discount if you come to the class beforehand. So we'll figure it out. Let us know you come.
Yeah, and Spring Retreat is coming up June 12th through 15th. 3 awesome days of going back to camp. There's sports, bonfire, lots of activities, connecting to new friends, old friends. So if you have any questions about that, you can email me or miriam@jewishexperience.org. We can help you find the link to sign up. Should be really, really fun.
How far in advance do you have to sign up?
Sorry?
How far in advance?
As far in advance as if you want to sign up today, that would be great.
Right now.
Right now would be great.
People
don't
sign up last,
people sign up last moment, but we don't love that. And so then also our Israel Day Parade, June 1st, we're going to get cool t-shirts, and we'll be marching down Fifth Avenue. So again, if you have any questions, email me. There's also a bunch of flyers on the table for all the upcoming events, so any questions, refer to that. And also, as Rabbi Feldman mentioned, we're having our Israel trip August 9th through 17th. So.
And one other program we didn't put on the list is Monday night, June 4th, is the holiday of Shavuot. And on the east side of Fifth Avenue Synagogue, we'll have a whole program of dinner and learning. So keep that in mind as well. So that's what's coming up. Thank you, Lee. Joshua Klein,
hi.
Hebrew class, where do we...
6:45, we need to go back to time. Back in time, to time, before time. We're learning about time. We stopped today because we're learning about Yom HaZivuot, but we'll be learning about
Yom
session on time.
Okay. Yom. All right. Okay, there we go. And that's it. We got some falafel, Israeli salad, and Israeli music, Chag Sameach, happy holiday, and
we should maybe not read it on the 28th.